This is Lo-Fi Lit. Today I'm talking to Mike Top, part of the Unbearables, and also I believe the Alt-Lit movement with Chelsea Martin. So you started out in Illinois?
You grew up there? Yeah, I grew up there. I was born in Washington, D.C.
And then you moved to Rhode Island?
Yes, after I lived in Denmark a little bit before that, and I met someone in Denmark, and they told me I should move to Rhode Island. And
how'd you end up in Denmark?
I majored in advertising in college.
Yeah.
My advisor was Draper Daniels. That's the guy where they got the name from Mad Men, Don Draper.
Because for real?
Draper Daniels. I think he invented the Marble Man, Elsie the Borden Cow, and all this stuff. And then I just kind of got sick of advertising, so I asked him if I could go to Europe and study advertising there. And I wanted to go there because they had no advertising classes. So then I just started reading a whole bunch, and I read William Burroughs there, and then I went to Tangier because I wanted to write a paper on William Burroughs, and blah, blah, blah.
So William Burroughs is like the guy that inspired you?
Early on, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of inspirations, but yeah, he was one person.
Like, he really spoke. Like, he was one of the first, though, for like poetry.
I mean, initially, like, I was interested in really great poets, like Dylan Thomas or George Trakl, and then I realized I could never write like them. So then I became more interested in William Burroughs. Like, he used like cut-ups and collage and stuff, so I thought maybe I can do something like him.
And you've mentioned, I think, Walt Whitman too.
Yes, I really like Walt Whitman. I mean, he's really great.
So what did you like about him?
Just the way he observes people, and like, he's very observant, and then he's part of a crowd, and he loves being part of the crowd, and his cadences, I think, are really interesting.
So you're in Denmark, and you're doing William Burroughs.
Right.
So how do you, so you meet someone, and then you go back to the U.S.?
Yeah, I met this guy in Denmark, and I went to Tangier the first time by myself. I went 3 times, and then the second time I said to this guy he should go with me. You know, it was a lot of fun and stuff. And then he wanted to smuggle hash out of the country, and I told him that was a really bad idea. And then he did it anyway. And then when we were leaving, we were in the customs line, and he got caught, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I didn't know whether to like leave or pretend I wasn't with him or anything, but somehow I got in touch with him and told him to lie and say his dad was like in the House of Representatives, and to bribe them and give them money. So they did that.
So what's your family background like for you to end up in Denmark?
I'd say like middle class, maybe lower middle class. I don't know, around there.
Were your parents cool with you going to Denmark?
My dad died when I was 14, so he didn't care. And my mom, I think, she thought it was good. She thought it was exciting, yeah.
And this was like in the 70s?
This is 1979.
Oh, that's awesome. I bet it was fun back then.
Yes, it was a lot of fun.
Was it like, I don't know, peaceful, or was it like dynamic or something? I don't know.
Are we talking Tangier or Denmark? Or?
Yeah, Denmark or Tangier.
Denmark was really cool because they had, I'm probably mispronouncing it, they had like Christianhaven, which is still there. It's like a commune, like in the middle of Copenhagen, and you could buy like drugs there, and the police wouldn't really go there, and the firefighters wouldn't really go there, and it was kind of a self-governing sort of anarchist commune. So that was kind of interesting. I went back there a couple of years, 2 or 3 years ago, though, and you know, now it's like kind of too druggy. It's more meth-like. So,
oh, for real?
Yeah, and Denmark was just, yeah, it was just really interesting. It was so different than the U.S., and I was such a rube, you know. There was no internet then, so
yeah,
you weren't really exposed to things like.
When you were in advertising, did other like advertisers look down on you that you're like reading poetry and shit?
I didn't work for any advertising companies. I just majored in it, and then I switched. And after I lived in Rhode Island, I thought I'm unemployed here now. I'm never gonna get ahead anywhere in Rhode Island. Like, so two of my friends wanted to come to New York City and buy heroin, so I went with them. And then I've told the story a million times, but it's funny and sort of trip. We drove to New York City and we went to the Lower East Side, and then my friend asked for directions, and this guy just reached to the window and like punched him in the face for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, I was like, this place is exciting. I want to move here. So then I needed some kind of excuse, so I decided to apply to grad school at NYU.
Oh, cool. So did you do heroin?
No.
Never?
My friend, no, because I have too addictive a personality. So okay. I knew if I did it, because my friends were both like, oh, we're not addicted, we're just like snorting it, and then they ended up like shooting up, and then, you know.
So what were they like when they were on it?
I wasn't around them much when they did it, because they would usually do it with other people who did heroin, you know. I mean, you know, you just learn to recognize, you know, they're on the nod, you know, they don't want to eat anything except candy, they get a really bad complexion and stuff. Now it's very easy for me to spot a junkie.
Now, were you like accepting of it though? Like it was cool with you? Like you didn't mind it?
Yeah, these guys were my close friends before that. So I kind of told them, you know, that I didn't think they should do it, you know. And then they were, like I said, they were both like, oh, we're just snorting it, you know, we're cool, everything's fine. And then one friend, it went really badly.
But like this was before like the whole culture war of like the war on drugs. So was it like still like looked down on, but maybe not as much?
I don't think people looked down on it. I think people thought it was kind of like cool and stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So, okay. So you go to New York in like 1981, 82-ish.
Yes,
and this is
right.
When like the AIDS epidemic is like just kicking off. Did you see signs of that while you're like your life is paralleling like living there?
There wasn't like that much information about AIDS at first. I remember I didn't have a lot of money, and I had a Chemex coffee pot, and I fixed it with crazy glue, which was like really a stupid thing to do, because every day I'm pouring boiling water over it, over the crazy glue. And then I got all these blisters inside my mouth, so I had no idea what that was. So then I went to a doctor, and then they started like saying, so do you sleep with guys? And I was like, no, I'm married. And they're like, well, we don't care if you're married, are you sleeping with any guys? And I go, no. And I was like, and they misdiagnosed and about all these blisters with some early AIDS symptom. Even they didn't know much about AIDS then. This was like, I don't know, 83 or so. And then my brother came and visited me and said, you're drinking crazy glue, quit drinking crazy glue and you're blisters will go away.
Wait, you were, the crazy glue was getting in your coffee?
Yeah, because I was pouring boiling water into the pot and it was slowly dissolving the crazy glue into my coffee.
God, I didn't even know that was like something you could drink.
So then I think, then a couple of years later, then I think people became much more aware of AIDS, because like Keith Haring dying and, you know, all these, you know, I lived on the Lower East Side then, it was like really cheap. And my first apartment was like $325 a month and had a wood burning fireplace.
So like, could you take us through like a typical day, like in your early, like 1982 when you're living there?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to school. I studied with Galway Kinnell. I don't know if you know him. He was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. He was kind of a big deal in like the 60s or 70s. So I studied with him. So I was going to school. And I had like really crappy jobs. Like I worked as a messenger, like a foot messenger, because I thought that was fun. Like, you know, I got to travel all over the city. So I did that a lot. My neighbor downstairs was really annoying and crazy. He would play YMCA like about 24 times a day. I'm not joking. Or he'd play One Bad Apple by the Osmonds was the other song he played.
The big disco guy.
Yeah, he was a little gay guy with he would wear like a cowboy hat, and there were cracks in the floors, and I could hear everything he's saying, you know, like, and it's just like, so he was very annoying. And then I started pouring water through the floorboards on him after a while. then the music stopped and everything. So the neighborhood was very dangerous then too. There was like a lot of drugs. My landlord lived in the building and he was very paranoid. He had all these books about like what to do in case of riots and stuff.
I mean, that's probably smart though.
Yeah. Two guys tried to mug me about 6 months after I moved in.
Wow.
And I fought them off, not like all heroically. I mean, I screamed because I read men never yell when they're getting mugged or attacked. So I screamed and everyone from this bar came out and my landlord came out and no one helped me.
Oh my God.
And then I asked my landlord, I said, Alan, how come you didn't help me? Why didn't you do anything? And he goes, they might have had a knife or a gun, you know? And I was like, okay, I'll look out for you too. You know?
So I was going to ask, while you're doing all this, were you like forming your craft?
Yeah, because it was really, I mean, it was just such an unbelievably great environment, like around 81, 82. Like I would see Keith Haring in the subway all the time. Like my first wife lived on the Upper West Side, so I'd always be like traveling back and forth and I'd see him in like Times Square, like painting all the time. There was a playwright who had gotten out of jail named Miguel Pinheiro. He wrote a book called Short Eyes, which is about child molester in prison. So he was kind of like a fringy, kind of well-known guy. And he lived in a squat, like just six doors down. I'd be like, can you look at my writing, you know? And then he'd look at it and, you know, he'd give you criticism and everything. There was a magazine called Between C and D around 1984. And they published like David Wojnarowicz and Barbara Kruger and people like that. And I got in it a couple times, so it was all thrilling. And that was in the window of Gotham Book Mart on 47th Street. That was a famous bookstore then. So I went up and looked in the window. And I was like, look, I'm in a magazine that's in the window of the Gotham Book Mart, you know?
Did you ever see Leroy Jones or Baraka?
No, I didn't see him. I knew this other guy. I'm trying to think of his name right now. I'll let you know when it comes to me.
So when do you and Ron form like the Unbearable group?
I don't think I was involved. Well, I don't think I wasn't involved in the formation of that group. That was like Ron Colm. And I think there was a guy somehow associated with Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pick his name right now. And then they had some kind of like document asserting what the Unbearables were about and everything. And then mainly it was just guys, they all seemed to like drink beer a lot. So then they invited me, Sparrow, a guy named Hal Sirowitz, who is a poet. And then I think 20 to 30 other people.
Wow.
And they had some women in there, but it was all, you know, super white, super. I think there was like one or two Asian women. It wasn't very representational.
How'd you meet Sparrow?
I think I met him through that group, and it was really funny because I lived in Stuyvesant Town, which starts at 14th Street, and he lived on 9th Street, and we just rode each other for 5 years before we ever met. We never.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, and then
that's some internet shit right there.
Yes, that was really amusing. Like we just would send each other postcards all the time, and then finally we met after like 5 years. And he's like, "I thought you were like a man in his 50s who collected parakeets." He said. And, so then we met, and then the best thing with Sparrow was like we've collaborated on two books, but I mean, the most fun is like we do readings together. And I don't know if you remember or have ever heard of like G. Gordon Liddy or Timothy Leary. Like,
I know Timothy Leary.
He was a big acid guru, and G. Gordon Liddy worked for like Nixon. He was like some aide or something. And those guys went on tour, like G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary is the big acid advocate, and then G. Gordon Liddy is the uptight Nixonian aide. So that's their yin and yang. So I thought kind of Sparrow and me were like that. Like I was all clean cut and short haired and shaven, and Sparrow like looked like a big hippie and had a long beard and, you know, would get stopped by the police all the time. And so I thought it was a good dynamic when we'd read together, like we look so different. But then I love reading with him. We read all the time. We just read this place upstate. It was like a lot of fun.
So the way that you write, where you write like single sentences, like was that always how you wrote from day one?
Like I said, I started, I think, to try and like emulate poets like Dylan Thomas and George Trakl, and realized like I was just terrible. And then when I moved to New York, then I started reading like poets like Joe Brainard, and he was like really funny. And then, this is not so complimentary, then I was reading other poets like in the New York school, it's what they were called. And then I was like, these guys aren't very good. I could do as good as them, you know, like, so that was, then I started modeling myself a little bit on them. And Joe Brainard wrote a lot of short poems. And then I was also really inspired by William Wegman, the artist.
The one with the dogs.
Yeah, everyone knows him for the dogs, but he did all these great videos in the 70s. And he also wrote a lot of really short stories. And he just lived like a block from me. So I started writing him too. And then he would send me like his stories, and he would write little postcards. And he was really inspirational because he was funny. You know, poetry was very still super serious, like in the 70s, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, everyone was like, I want to be like John Ashbery, you know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, John Ashbery is witty, but I mean, no one's like William Wegman, or Joe Brainard was very funny too. So it was kind of like,
did you ever meet Joe?
No, I'm not so shy now, but I was like super shy then. That's why it was easier to write people. So I would just write William Wegman. I mean, he illustrated my last book last year, but I still have never met him. We've just written each other or like a email and stuff like that. And Joe Brainard, I wrote him a couple times and I published him, and he wrote me some letters and everything.
Well, I mean, you guys wrote, I mean, I think like even writing to someone, I mean, that's just because you're not meeting physically, you're still like talking intellectually. So, I mean, like, I think that's just as good or better. I would say even better.
Yeah. It was really a great atmosphere for that. And then Ted Berrigan was another like inspiration, that Ted Berrigan, the poet, like, because he said, if you live in New York City, I mean, they still had phone books then. Mm-hmm. He said, you should get the phone book and you should write, you know, your favorite artists and writers, and ask if you can publish them. And they'll usually say yes.
Is that like, for real?
Yeah, because he wrote Andy Warhol, and then Andy Warhol wrote him back and published him. So then I went to guest edit an arts magazine. It was called New Observations. Like, I didn't have to come up with the money. This other guy fronted all the money. So I said, can I be a guest editor? He's like, yes. So then I just started writing people. And I wrote John Cage, the musician. I mean, he was like super famous at the time. This is like 1991 or so. So I wrote him, and then I came home from work. My wife called. I remember my wife said to me, she's like, John Cage called you. And I was like, what? You know, I like couldn't believe it. And he said, sure, I'll be in it. And then once I had John Cage, this is like a sleazy strategy, but Ted Berrigan also said, you should do this. If you reel in one famous person, then you should mention whoever else you write. Say, John Cage is in this issue. Would you like to be in it also? And then the goes along. And then the more people you get, then you're like, oh, blah, 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 blah. So it was really good. And then
I do that with my podcast when I email people. Like, this person was on it and this person was on it.
Yes, yes. I looked at your lineup and I was like, wow, he's had some heavy hitters on his show, you know, or his podcast. Yeah. Now it sounds like.
Who do you consider heavy?
I don't know. I saw you had like DT Robbins, I think.
Yeah.
So I was like, he's super famous. But then I liked that you had like Aaron Birch and mm-hmm. Kyle. I can't pronounce Tribal. His name. Yes, that's it. The hey, you asshole guy.
Yeah.
So then I thought, oh, whoa, what a great mix.
Yeah. So what did Joe Brainard say to you, like in his letters?
I would just say,
because you guys have a like very familiar, like very, it's very similar like style.
Yeah, his letters, there he would handwrite them on like school notebook paper, like line paper. Mm-hmm. I wish I still had the letter. I think I gave it to NYU or something. But I think a better contact I made was I published Raymond Pettibon in 1993. And then he and I have been in contact since then. And we wrote a zine together in 2014. And they kind of fell out of contact. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, then we started interacting on Twitter like every day, like writing to each other and, you know, retweeting and responding. And then he said someone asked him to write a book. So he asked if I wanted to join him. So we wrote this book together that came out last year. And that was a lot of fun. And then he illustrated it too. And then I thought he'd be sick of me after we did that book. But then we saw each other and we're like, let's do something else. And now we're doing a zine right now. And that's going to come out later this year.
Now, this was in the, you came up in the 80s. Were you like reading any comics?
No, I think I saw Ray's zines in the, there was one bookstore in the East Village that had all of his zines. So I would see them there and I would, I would start buying them all. Cause I was also really into fringy publications. I worked at a place called Franklin Furnace that was run by this woman named Martha Wilson when I was like 24. And all they did was collect avant-garde literature. And it was next door to, or not next door, nearby Printed Matter, which is a bookstore in New York City that has like art fairs every year. And so I would always go to Printed Matter and I'd be like, what's this weird Richard Prince zine? I'm going to buy it. And so I was always collecting zines like right away.
So if you hadn't grown up or gone to New York, none of this probably would have ever happened. Do you think you would have been a writer?
I think it had like a beneficial effect on me, like, because in Illinois, like I would go to this coffee house and it sounds mean, but I mean, just all the poets there were terrible, you know, like I couldn't learn anything from them. And then when I went to Rhode Island, I met quote unquote, like one or two real poets, but then, you know, they were just still. And then when I moved to New York City, like, everything was so interesting. I was really also even more interested probably in art than poetry. Like I became really interested in art because I had no money and you could go to art galleries for free. And people were so nice. There was a gallery run by a woman named Holly Solomon, and she would exhibit William Wegman. She would just have me come to her gallery and sit in the back room and just say, have at it, you know, look through all these drawings of his. Here's a big stack of 100. So, you know, you just can't put, everyone was so, I said nice 10 times, but everyone was so nice, you know, it was just like trying to help you out.
And is your writing, do you think it was inspired by art? Or did it like, it's just like everything that you took in?
I think everything I took in, but also the artist, they seem more advanced than the writers. The writers, like I said, you know, were very serious, and a lot of the artists were trying to have more fun, or they were more conceptual. The poets were still doing stuff like, you know, they were writing poems like, I'm in the kitchen, you come home, what's for dinner, you know? And then the artists were all like guys like John Baldessari or William Wegman, Joseph Kosuth, they were doing like conceptual or funny things. And I thought that's more up my alley. And they also seem more like the poets seem more concerned with their feelings. And then the artists, it was like, I was really into Marcel Duchamp. Like, and Duchamp was always talking about Leonardo da Vinci. And Leonardo da Vinci said, art was, I'm going to mispronounce this, una cosa mental. It's a mental thing. It's not like like art isn't really like, to Leonardo, it wasn't putting out your feelings. It was that thought, you know, it was an idea. So that was very interesting to me.
Yeah. Like back in the day, I used to buy up magazines. Like I go to a bookstore and buy up magazines, and I was always more like impressed or like taken by the art magazines than like the poetry ones. Cause the poetry ones would be bland and boring. And then like the art, like it was way more creative. I felt like.
Yes. And I ended up working at Art Forum magazine for a little bit there. And then when I worked there, I remember, this goes back to Rhode Island, they were asking me what was wrong with this one person who was the photo editor, they're like, why is she so peculiar? And I was like, she's a junkie. Because she's always in the bathroom. She's eating candy all the time. She had a terrible complexion. So
is candy like, really a thing with junkies?
I think, yes, I think so. I really like this sweetness.
Okay. So I also noticed on Twitter you post a lot of like professional wrestling stuff. Were you watching pro wrestling back in the day?
I think that comes more from my grandfather would watch pro wrestling and like in the 60s. And I remember seeing like pro wrestling and but I didn't really like it. But then like Raymond Pettibon, like I collaborate with, he's like really into pro wrestling. And there's a phrase in wrestling called, I think I'll mispronounce this to it. I think it's kayfabe.
K-A-Y.
Yeah, that's it. Is that it?
Yeah, and kayfabe.
And do you know what it is? Can you explain it to me? You probably explain it better than me.
It's a language within the wrestling world where they speak to each other, but like outsiders aren't supposed to understand it.
Yes.
I think.
Yes, it's something like that. And then Ray told me to understand his whole art, you had to understand kayfabe. Then now, yes, we write a lot about wrestlers. And the great thing about collaborating with Ray is then, like, he's very esoteric. Like, he'll tweet something about somebody, and I'm like, who the fuck is Buddy Love, you know? And then I'll, like, look it up, and he's a professional wrestler. I'll go to Wikipedia. But then, like, interact with him. I want him to know, like, I was interested in what he said. So I looked it all up on Wikipedia. So then I come back with a very reasoned response, and I'll use the guy's real name, you know, like, and so I think I was into baseball a lot when I was young, and Ray is super into baseball also. So I think more common area for us is baseball. Like when we are together, that's what we talk about a lot, baseball.
Were you swimming back then? Because I know you're a big swimmer.
I always swam, but then I always swam pretty much every day since I was 5.
Damn.
And now my second wife, though, she's like 8 years younger than me, and she's like a super athlete. Like she is a, I don't know if you can see behind me, it's a painting of a swimming pool by someone.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I hope this video is not showing I didn't shower or anything. Anyway, she's a big swimmer in master swimming. Do you know what master swimming is?
No.
Master swimming is like it's an organization, it's across the country, and people who are like college swimmers or just regular swimmers, they compete in meets based on age groups, like 20 to 24, 25 to 29, 45 to 49, blah, blah, blah. And you're in these 5-year age groups, and people talk about aging up and everything. So she's been like a champion in her age group for like, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. I mean, like, not like, she wasn't like, I'll brag about her. She wasn't like number 3. She would always be like number 1 in the country for like 20 years. Like,
whoa.
For like, not just freestyle, but like many events, like backstroke, breaststroke. She'd be like number 1 in the country for age group for like 5 or 6 different strokes and pool lengths. So then she's always razzing me about not being a master swimmer, saying I swam like Deepak Chopra or something like that. Meaning very leisurely. So then I joined master swimming in about 2007. And I have a Russian swim coach I've had since then named Igor. And he keeps me swimming. It's very funny. He's like 85. He can still do pull-ups and everything.
Damn. So were you ever drawn to like writing like nonfiction or fiction or like a novel or anything?
Sparrow and me wrote a novel in 2016 called The Double Dream of Spring. And like, if I were like David Lynch, which I'm not, but I really like David Lynch. So
was that the cover where like there's a purple like circle thing?
Yeah, it's Miranda July did the cover.
Yeah.
Same thing, just wrote her. I didn't know her or anything. And then also, well, you know, you got all those people on your show, you know what to say. So anyway, she did the cover, and then Sparrow and me wrote this novel. We collaborated, but I think it's like really bad, you know, it's not very good. Neither of us is good at long form. And then I was also I had never read Philip K. Dick, so I was reading all of his books.
So you, when you reach out to people, are people, do people still respond?
Yes.
Do you ever find, did anyone ever not respond and you like thought they were a dick afterwards?
No, I don't think I've ever really had anyone turn me down. I try and be like really polite and really respectful and just really short and mm-hmm. kind of like professional and stuff. Like, I mean, you know that photographer, Robert Frank?
No.
He's a really famous photographer. He did a book in the 50s. It's very famous, called The Americans. You should look it up anyway. Oh, you know the Rolling Stones, right?
Yeah.
That band. So he did the cover for Exile on Main Street, I think. It's a double album, and has a bunch of like weird photos. And that's Robert Frank. He did all the photos. He's also collaborated with Patti Smith when he was alive. He lived on Bleecker Street, and I wrote him. And everyone said he was real curmudgeon, and he said, yeah, come on over. So I just went over to his studio, and like we talked for like a half hour, an hour. It's like real. He signed a copy of The Americans for me. It was like a very thrilling sort of thing.
Would you ever publish your letters to people?
I don't think I really have them. I mean, NYU bought all my papers when I was like 42 or 44. They were in a big acquisition spree, and they were trying to, Ron Cole had encouraged them to form what they called the Downtown Collection. So they were collecting all these writers who lived on the Lower East Side. So they bought all my papers, all my letters. That's where my Joe Brainard letter disappeared to. And now with email, like, you know, it's just like, I don't really write letters so much anymore. I mean, I wrote a physical letter to Robert Frank, and if I write it, no, I think he, no, even if I want people to contribute something now, I just write them an email.
When you get published like in anthologies and stuff, I think it's hilarious because it'll like, you'll come up and it'll just be like one line while everyone else has like pages and pages.
I think like in the 90s, there was a magazine called Exquisite Corpse, and then it was edited by this guy named Andrei Kudrescu. He's this great writer, and most people were like, I was getting, in the 80s, I got published a lot, like I was in between C&D, and that magazine had a lot of cachet. And then I think in my late 20s and early 30s, then I kind of like stagnated, like, and you know, I just had like crappy jobs and it was depressing and everything. And then this magazine, Exquisite Corpse, came out, and then Andre was okay with me writing something like two lines and stuff. So that was kind of refreshing. Then he would put me in every issue. And there was also, I'm really rambling here. There was another magazine in the 80s called Public Illumination Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still around to this day. They used to publish every month, and they published like Keith Haring, and they published John Ashbery. People said they published David Wojnarowicz, but I don't think they really did. And the only thing was you had to use a pseudonym. You couldn't use your real name. So then I used my real name because I thought my name sounded like a fake name anyway. So then the guy was kind of angry when he found out, but then we're still friends. Okay. Yeah. So he also had a fake name. He would always sign all his letters to me as Dr. Zagreus Bowery. And I didn't find out his real name for like 20 years, but now I know his real name. Yes. Yes.
So, I was going to ask you, when you went from publishing and like print magazines to online, did you have a problem with going to online?
No, I liked that a lot because also it meant technology is great. Before, it was just like, you know, everyone else had control over like what was being published and everything. Like in my 20s, I became friends with, really good friends with this publisher, Barney Ross, that he ran Grove Press. They're the ones who published like Lady Chatterley's Lover and William Burroughs and Jack Baraka. Kerouac and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's really from a rich, wealthy family. The other avant-garde publishing company was called New Directions. That was run by James Laughlin. And he was also from a really rich family. Like, Laughlin, Jones and Laughlin Steel. So it was like, gee, to get something out, do you have to be really rich? And I was always interested in the lifestyles of people. I was like, how did Garcia Lorca write all that great poetry? And I was like, oh, he's really rich and never had to work. Or how did Gertrude Stein like buy all those paintings? Like, oh, she's from a really rich family and never had to work. And then I was like, I'm like a lower middle class proofreader, you know, in New York City. Like, so I thought that technology, that it was great. And then like, I really liked David Lynch and he also really embraced it. And then I edited an online magazine in like 2004 called The Real Poetic. I guess I did that for a lot of years. And that was a lot of fun. I published such weird people in that, like John Baldessari I published. I'm trying to think of this hippie singer in Seattle. I'll have to email you the name later or something. I can't think of his name. But yeah, anyway, to make a short story long, I was really into online magazines. And then McSweeney's came out.
Mm-hmm. I saw you published there.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that editor, what's his name? Dave Eggers. Mm-hmm. He was kind of interesting, you know, like, he was sort of refreshing, you know. He would send you like an invitation. Everyone was so serious, like I said, you know, still. And then he'd write me and say, like, can you come to a barbecue at my place this weekend? He goes, your friends can't come. Your friends are assholes. It's like, wow, that's good.
So when you send like one of your things out, like your writings, are you like, do you like debate over what to send, or do you know exactly what you're going to send?
No, I have a hard time figuring out. Like, now, like another benefit of working so closely with Raymond Pettibon is like, don't tell him this, is that I don't send anything to, if he doesn't retweet it, then I won't send it to a magazine. Oh. Almost. That's my rule. Now and then, there's maybe three things I've sent out in like the last 5 years that he hasn't retweeted, and I thought, well, he just didn't see that or something, because that one was genius. So then I'll send it out. But he's my de facto editor.
You must have been exhilarating when like Twitter came around. It was like, that's exactly almost your thing.
I didn't really get into it. I think I've been on it since like 2007, but I didn't really understand it or have fun with it until like then I started like working with Raymond Pettibon on it. Like I'm so dopey in a lot of ways, you know. Like I was very shy, like social media. I was like, I think only like 5 years ago I was like, I'm supposed to interact with other people on this, you know, not just like put out my own dumb writing every day. Like, so now I interact with people, so now it's a lot more fun. It seems like I finally got it when I'm like at age 62 or so.
You kind of found like a new popularity out of it, I think.
Yes. And then I've always been super lucky, I think, like in that, like in the 80s, like I was in between C&D. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, I was in between like Exquisite Corpse, which had a lot of, there's that word again, cachet. And then I was in McSweeney's in 2000. And then I just always feel like I'm lucky. It's like then in the aughts, then I worked a lot with a publishing genius. That was a press in Baltimore. They're still around.
And I saw Blake Butler even like interviewed you in like 2010.
Yes.
On HTML Giant, and that was like a big thing.
Yeah, so that was just like, I felt, this is the greatest, you know, like I'm an old guy and like the young people are still finding out about me. And then in 2022 or whatever, after I started working with Ray, then I felt like I kind of like really broke on through. Like I wrote Ted Berrigan's son, Edmund Berrigan was editing the Brooklyn Rail. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and you weren't even allowed to submit anything to him or anything, you know, he had to somehow contact you. So I wrote him a polite, nice, professional short letter, very considerate. And then I said, can I send you something? He said, send me 7 pages, which I was like, unheard of. Wow. So I sent him like 29 things, you know, I don't know if I can call them poems, 29 like tweets pretty much they were. They're all like almost exactly the same length. I was trying to fill the limit for some reason, like 140 characters. I don't know why that is. Some, you know, compulsive thing. So then he wrote me and he's like, these are terrific. And he didn't change like anything, like not one word. And I was like, wow. And then that was a print magazine too, Brooklyn Rail. So then that was very exciting because like I play poker once a month with these guys, and even they saw it. Like, I mean, they're not publishers. They're like, hey, I saw you in the Brooklyn Rail. So that was very exciting. And then after that, then I started seeing what other magazines were out there that, you know, I might like to contribute to or be involved with. So they're like Had Magazine or Hobart or those kind of things. That's what I've been writing to.
So what were your jobs like? Like, did you ever use your advertising degree to get into like a big job?
No. I got an NYU. I went to NYU. I got a master's in poetics, not like a creative writing. All I did was like study poetry. It's a very useful degree. My wife's a philosophy major too, so we're both paired for real life really well. No, I just got a job as a proofreader with McKinsey and Company. That was my first job. The management consultants, like I remember Henry Kissinger worked in the building and he had two guys accompany him with machine guns all the time.
Wait, for real?
Yes, because he worked in the same building as McKinsey. And one time I came to work and he got on the elevator and then he was with these two guys and they had trench coats with, I know I'm making this up, and they had machine guns on them. And then he just like looked at me and said it was okay for me to come in the elevator because I was like a 24-year-old baby face, you know, like I didn't look like
that's
I posed
no
a threat. Yeah. So then, so I just had crappy jobs and terrible jobs, just terrible, like trade magazine jobs.
But you're still working within like the industry, I guess, even if they're shitty jobs.
I think I kind of got a better job in like 2002. I started working at McGraw-Hill, like the educational publisher. And that was kind of like okay, like it wasn't too hard.
The big money.
It wasn't that big of money. It was pretty bad. But then around 2009, I got transferred to the Spanish department and it was run by this guy named Ernesto. And he was like really cultured and really interesting. He was half Italian, half Uruguayan. So then he and I got along really fabulously. And then my job became a lot more fun. Like his English was really not very good. And I was making fun of him, which was very PC. You know, instead of saying, what does that mean? He would say things like, what does that mean? You know, so I'd make him watch Cool Hand Luke with me. I don't know if you know that movie.
Yeah, I know that movie.
There's a scene where this prison warden, I think he just is saying to the prisoners, what we have here is a failure to communicate. So I'd ask Ernesto to practice that line again and in his bad English. And that was a lot of fun.
So when you're hanging out with people like like came up with like Grove Press, like were you asking them questions or were you like going out to dinner with them? Were you like hanging out at parties with them?
I met Bernie Rossett and my wife and me, he started asking us out. He had a place in East Hampton. So we'd go out there every weekend and I was really into basketball and so was he. So we'd watch the Bulls and the Detroit Pistons. This is around like 1988 and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then he needed an assistant. So he couldn't decide whether to hire me or my wife at the time. And then he hired my wife. So I was crushed, but I mean,
wow, what a dick.
Well, she is Asian. She's like really good looking and he was really into that terrible thing where like I'm really into Asian women. Like it doesn't even matter their personality, you know, like as long as they're Asian. So then he hired her. Then I think I was better off not working for him. Like then it was better for our friendship. And we just played pool all the time. And he would introduce me to people, but I was really naive. I couldn't parlay that into anything useful. You know, I met like John Oakes. I met who's the guy? He's in Lost Highway. He's a really rich guy. He had his ear cut off. Anyway, he's in Lost Highway. My memory's really going.
You didn't want to like punch him after he told you that about your wife? You didn't get like territorial? Like, don't look at my wife like that.
No, it was good. It was like I said, it's just kind of better for our relationship, because then he was like a, I think probably like a terrible boss, like very demanding, like, you know, you know, he's kind of like Mr. Pitt in Seinfeld or something. I don't know if you're familiar with that reference, like very demanding.
Did you go to like concerts and stuff? Did you go to comedy shows? Or was it mostly art? Poetry?
In New York, I didn't really, I saw some music when I came to New York, but like I saw James Brown a lot.
Wow.
Or I'd see B.B. King. But before New York, I actually went to a zillion concerts. Like when I was in Denmark, and then when I was in Rhode Island, then I saw like the Ramones probably like six times. I know I saw the Talking Heads six times. This is another story I tell all the time. I saw the Dead Kennedys, and do you know the Dead Kennedys?
Yeah.
So there's the lead singer is Joe Biafra, but the great part about seeing the Dead Kennedys is John F. Kennedy Jr. was standing next to me at the concert, because he went to Brown, and then like Joe Biafra was spitting all over us. It was very exciting. I got the sleeves of my leather coat ripped off, and didn't think that was possible. It was a very exciting concert. So yeah, I didn't see a lot of the concert in New York, I think, because of like the money thing. So I was seeing more art and performances and stuff like that.
Did you ever consider selling drugs?
I'd sold weed in college.
You did? Was it lucrative?
No, you could buy like, I just kept myself in weed. Like you could buy, I think, a quarter pound for $105. And then there were these things called lids. I feel like the furry freak brothers talking about lids. Instead of, I think a lid was maybe, I don't know, 4 ounces. I can't remember. Anyway, yeah, I would just sell, I would get four lids for 105, and then I could keep one if I sold the other for like more money. So that was my drug dealing.
Did you ever communicate with D.A. Powell?
No.
Okay. Because I saw him like retweet you once.
Oh, wait. I take that back. I have communicated with him. He tried to publish me on some Subway thing, and he promoted me, and then they turned me down. He told me that was like a, that was maybe 15 years ago. Like I still follow him on Twitter. He's a pretty funny guy.
So he asked for you, and then he turned you down.
No, he didn't turn me down. He proposed that I be in some series of poems that would appear on the New York City subways.
Oh, cool. And then you got turned down by the company place?
Yeah, whoever was in charge of, like, who was employing him. Like, he was like an advisor, and then they just said no or whatever. Oh. I mean, but I think also, is, you know, I kind of go in these, you know, I'm hot, I'm not. And I think I was in kind of a, like a slump then. So, like,
do you feel like when you look back at that time when you're writing, do you like look down at your writing? Or do you not? It doesn't affect you? Or you're like, that was actually pretty good?
I would say look down, you know, but if I look back, you know, I'm very picky. I can say, like, oh, I've only written like 20 things I think are okay or something. Now my head's much bigger, so I'd raise the number. But for a long time, until like 4 or 5 years ago, I'd be like, God, I've really only written like 20 things. I have a little chapbook I could send you. It's like called The Poetry. It's called The Poetry Jug. You send me your address, I'll just send it to you free. Anyone else who wants to, you know, tell them to get in touch with me, I'll send them one free. I have a zillion. But it's only like 21 things. I kind of thought like when I was like 62 or so, I was like, I'm done. And then I started collaborating with Raymond Pettibon, and it's like, wow, this is really fun again, you know. And
do you have a writing schedule, like every day you sit down to write?
Yeah, now I do. But I think like 5 years ago, I was only having like 5 or 6 poems published a year. Like I used to write every night for an hour or two when in my 20s and 30s, like without fail, I'd sit down at 10 after 10 and write for an hour. And then I think like 5 or 10 years ago, then I was not writing so much because I was like, this isn't really good for my personal relationships when I just like ignore the person in my house for like an hour, you know, and say like, don't bother me. I'm like writing at 10 at night, you know? So I kind of stopped that, but now I write every day for probably like 1-2 hours.
But when you write, does it come out in the form that it's published in, or do you stick to that? Or does it come out just like in journal or diary form?
No, I sit down and I write something and then I work on it until I think it's good. And then I tweet it, if that's allowed to say.
Yeah. Does it ever get like no likes? And you're like, no, that's actually really good. I'm going to put it out anyways.
Because
sometimes the algorithm sucks and like doesn't pick up on something.
Yeah, I think you're kind of right. But, you know, like Ray said, I should ignore likes and stuff, but then he's much more independent than me. But I hear what you're saying, but yeah, I still, for some reason, bow a little bit to public opinion. And he's always like, you should never listen to anyone else. You should never, you know, let anyone tell you what to do or anything. But I have a harder time with that.
has anyone ever reached out to you like to teach a workshop or a class?
Never.
Never. Would you? If asked?
No, I don't think I'd be interested, because I think there was kind of like in the 20s and 30s, if you're a writer, then it was kind of like looked down on if you taught like at a university, then you weren't somehow like genuine. You were like a product of the academic establishment. There was definitely labels, and people would be like, he's an academic poet, you know, like, so I really didn't want to be involved with a university or a college or anything like that. I just wanted to work really crappy jobs instead that I didn't like.
What if it was X-Ray Magazine? They reached out to you to like teach a one-day workshop.
Well, that guy Chris, yeah, I'd do anything for him, sure.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
Have you guys hung out?
I've never met him. I've talked to him. He's like he's a really great editor. I mean, he's such a careful reader. I mean, it's unbelievable. And he has really good advice. I mean, I can't think of anything in the slightest bad about him. I mean, he's just terrific. He's really nice to, he's super enthusiastic. Like I said, he's like really supportive, a close reader. I can't say enough nice things about him.
Yeah, he's one of those figures that's kind of shrouded in mystery to me. I've always wanted him on because he used to have his own internet show, not internet show, but like interview series called like Neato Mosquito. And he would like interview the alt-lit people. I've always wanted him on, but I don't know how to contact him. I think he's off Twitter.
Oh, I have his email. I could give it to
you. Oh,
I don't think he'd mind. I guess I should ask him first, but I mean,
awesome.
His email, I could send it to you. You can get in touch with him tomorrow.
I feel like you could do like a workshop on like sending letters and like how to like write someone.
Maybe.
Because you're very funny, like you're a humorist kind of, and like I think it's surprising that you have a knack for communicating with people through letters. Because I feel like when I write someone, I never know if I'm doing it right, if it's going to go wrong, or because I can never stick to like a style or how. I don't know like the form or like the secret behind it, and it feels like you've cracked that.
I write like a business letter. I'd write, "Dear Tyler, I'm editing a literary magazine. Do you know who's in it? So-and-so, no. This great guy, this great
person." Very straightforward.
Person.
That's the best way. I found out that's the best way. Just to be like, I host a podcast. These are the people that have been on it. Here's the date. Do you agree or not? You know,
Eileen Miles will be in it. Mm-hmm. You'll be in it. And then I say, thank you for your time and consideration. And then if I write him a physical letter, then I put a self-addressed stamped envelope, so there's no excuse like, oh, I got to get a stamp and everything. Like, no, you don't have to do anything. All you have to do is write yes or no.
I found that if I put too many exclamation points or I get too excited, that seems to freak people out, and that ends the conversation there. And I feel
really?
Like when I don't do that, then I usually get people response. Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. I think I picked up on that from Chris. Like now I use exclamation points much more, because everything Chris would write me would be like, hi, Mike, 3 exclamation points. And I was like, his youthful enthusiasm appalls me. No, I'm joking. I was just, so then I was like, now I use more exclamation points. But in that letter, the people where I'd ask them, I never would use an exclamation point, but maybe that's
I love it when people do that and they send me like 3 or 4 exclamation points. But when I do it, I feel fake and inauthentic. And I feel like people can read through that and they see that I'm insecure or something.
It's imposter syndrome. I never heard of that term. It should have been invented like a long time ago. I mean, I feel like that all the time.
Yeah. Do you ever doubt your work?
No. Like I really liked Ernest Hemingway, which is probably a bad thing to say. Like his short stories, I thought he was really good. And like I said, I started writing like Dylan Thomas and George Trakel, but I had no talent. But then I saw this book about Ernest Hemingway, and it was called By Force of Will. So then I was like, that's going to be my model.
So how many years into writing do you felt like before you were good, you personally?
I guess I started writing like 18 or 19. I was insane. I mean, when I started writing poetry, I actually wore a beret.
Nice.
I smoked Turkish specials, because those are a cigarette that's very showy. They have like a gold filter and brown paper. They're from Turkey, obviously. So I was like super pretentious. And my poetry was absolutely so terrible. And then I think like after like 5 or 6 years, there's a guy's name I can't remember. He's a black writer, and he came to one of my readings at NYU, and then he kept heckling me. What was his name, Steve? He was a really famous Lower East Side poet, and then he kept heckling me during the reading too, you know, which is like, you know, I'm shy, there's some black guy I don't know, like heckling me. And then I was telling stories in between like my bad poems, like I was talking about my gay neighbor who was playing like YMCA all the time. And then he came up to me afterwards, after the reading, he goes, your poems stink. He goes, but your stories are much funnier. And he goes, you should quit writing poetry and just write funny stories. So then I took his advice.
But and then you wrote funny poems.
Yeah. And then the first things I had published in between C and D, I thought were like pretty good. I thought like there were 1 or 2 things I thought, these are really good, but they were still kind of serious. They were conceptual. I mean, they weren't like, when I was writing really bad poetry, again, it was that thing. It was like, here's my emotions, you know, like, and then the first things I had in C and D, they were kind of more constructed, more like conceptual, but then they weren't very funny. But that was kind of before I discovered like William Wegman and Joe Brainard so much. And then I think I kind of like slumped until like the 90s.
What do you think happened?
I think I would just get depressed, like having terrible jobs and like, I think with internet magazines, it's a lot easier to get published because it's just, I mean, when there were print magazines, they're expensive, and then there's, you know, they have big budgets and famous writers, you know, so you're always getting like turned down. So it was really banging your head against the wall. And with the internet magazines, it seems like anyone can be like, I'm going to do my own magazine and I'm going to have publish all my friends. And you're like, this is great.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like more encouraging, you know, like,
So I saw Sparrow, like, it said something like he invaded or he like ambushed like the New Yorker in the 90s to get into their magazine or something.
Yes. There was a famous, perhaps the most famous Unbearables moment is they all, especially Sparrow, start picketing the New Yorker office because he said, my poems are just as bad as the poems in your magazine, so I should be in it. And then I think they somehow like reached security. I mean, security was pretty non-existent pre 9/11. So I think they got into the New Yorker office, and then they eventually did publish a poem of his, I remember. And then he got paid a lot of New Yorker money and everything, so it was very exciting for him.
Do you think it was because of the pressure you put on them?
That, and I don't really understand like, the New Yorker, those kind of magazines. Like when I first moved to New York, I really wanted to be in like the Paris Review or the New Yorker like these kind of establishment avant-garde magazines. And then I was like, I'm never going to get in those things. I felt like they had a prejudice, like sort of, it was sort of like when you're applying for a job when you get out of college and they're like, you don't have any experience. And you're like, how am I going to get experience? And with these magazines, it was sort of the same way. It's like, you're not Charles Simic or you're not John Ashbery. So we're not even going to look at your stuff. It's just going to sit in the slush pile, you know?
Mm-hmm. So do you have any, like, have you ever like made, or do you have any advice on how to make a zine? By, like, if someone wanted to make one themselves and send it out to people? Do you have a process down?
I mean, I'm just doing one. I mean, I'm not doing it by myself. I'm like working with Ray. Like the way we would do it is I'll go over his place every now and then we'll collaborate like on drawings together. But then a lot of our collaboration is just online. And then it's insane. Like every interaction we've had on Twitter since 2022, like I keep it in a big giant Google Docs thing. Like it's the Ark of the Covenant or something. I don't know why. I just think like, this is the greatest. I want to keep our interaction because I'm never going to go through Twitter like back to like 2022 and read like the whole timeline. It's like Steve Jobs said about photos to someone. They were saying like, it's hard for me to organize all my old photos. And then he said, you are never going to look through all those old photos again. Everyone says they're going to, but they never are. So,
yeah. So did you pick it, the New Yorker with Sparrow?
No, I don't know why I didn't go to any of those things. I went to a lot of their readings and, oh, since you mentioned a zine, that was a really interesting, there was a magazine called Assembling in the 60s. And then Ron Colm, it was called Assembling because everyone would just bring 100 copies of their poem to this bar. And then everyone would just collate it all and staple it together, if you follow me. And then it'd be a magazine. So Ron Colm said we should do a zine like that the same way called I think it was called like the something with the Lower East Side and the title. And they did, I don't know, maybe 100 issues. And we would meet like once a month or every 2 months, but the same thing. You bring 100 copies of your poem to the Parkside Inn. That's this bar on Houston. And then everyone drinks beer and we meet in the afternoon. And then someone has a giant stapler. And then somebody who knows an artist gets an artist friend to do the cover. And then they staple a zine. So that would be one way to do a zine. You get all your friends to bring 100 pages to a bar. And then you have 100 copies of the zine. And everyone gets one. And then there's maybe 50 left over. And you try and like sell them to like some dopey bookstore like St. Mark's Books or something.
That's such a cool idea. I love that.
Yeah, that was really fun. And then there is very inclusive, you know, there's no exclusion, there's no editing, or you just bring your poem. Maybe it stinks, but then it's on you. You know, it's not on the editor.
Were there any poetry controversies like in the 90s or 80s?
I mean, I guess there were, but I mean, I didn't really
stay away.
Yeah, I didn't really get involved. I mean, so no, I don't think so.
Okay. So when Sparrow's like picketing New Yorker, are you like, that seems dangerous, I wouldn't want to do that?
No.
Were you like, hell yeah?
No, I was like, hell yeah.
Okay. How'd you get out of your slump?
Usually it's by like being inspired by some new person, like, or coming upon, like, you know, I'm always looking for like somebody who really like motivates me and want to do something. So it's like, oh, it's Eric Satie or it's William Wegman or Joe Brainerd or Marcel Duchamp or David Lynch. And then I read every single thing of theirs or see every movie they've done, or I just blanket myself on all their stuff. Like, or if I read Philip K. Dick, it's like, I'm not going to read one or two of his books. I'm going to read everything he ever wrote. And then that's kind of like a motivating thing.
So when like someone like David Lynch or Joe Brainerd passes away, does that have an effect on you?
Yeah. I was pretty upset about Joe Brainerd. And then, and David Lynch, that was very upsetting. You're like that poor guy, you know?
Mm-hmm. So but when,
he had such a good attitude about it, though. You know, he's into transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. So I started doing that too because David Lynch did. He's not even upset about dying. It's just like his family said, he just dropped his body, is what they said.
So when Joe Brainard passed away, did you see, I bet the poetry community was pretty like, that was a magnificent thing to happen, like a very depressing thing.
Yeah, and also he's an AIDS victim too, so.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
How did the community shift around you, like when something like that happens?
Yeah, I mean, there have been like a couple deaths, like when Ted Berrigan died, that was like a big deal because he was a big, a lot of people, like, he was their model, you know, just the way he lived and everything. Like, he didn't have any money, and he wrote all the time, and he tried all these techniques and everything. So I think that was, like, a big death. Or Keith Haring being a big death, or Basquiat, or mm-hmm. David Originaro. I mean, the list just goes on and on because people are always dying.
So do you remember the day that he passed away and what were you doing?
David Lynch?
No, Joe Brainard.
No, I don't really remember. Okay. I think that was the 90s. I think he's in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. He was born in like 43.
I was born in Tulsa.
Yeah, Tulsa. You're in Tulsa, right?
Yep.
So that's great. You've got Ted Berrigan, Ron Pazis from Tulsa, Joe Brainard.
Yeah, we don't really know that stuff. Like, that's not something that I learned until like 10 years ago. And uh-huh. like, other than that, there's not really any there's not like a literary scene here at all. That's why I go to the internet.
But that's the great thing about the internet. See, then you're not like, I think the internet's great, you know, for that.
Yeah. Sort of. Were you always into the internet, or like at first you're like cautious of it?
No, I was really into it. I mean, I really liked just the idea of email and connecting with people, and like, it seemed much easier, you know. You'd be like, hey, I'm going to like look up that person, you know, I went to college with, and write them and see if they write back. And then I thought that kind of stuff was easier to do.
So Chelsea Martin was like, was she one of the first people to write to you? Or do you like get a lot of fanfare?
She was one of the first. There was a woman named Amy Baradell who worked for McSweeney's, and she kind of wrote me a lot of funny things too. She posed as a confused bisexual Columbia University student, and she didn't use her real name, and she was doing this with some other guy, and they asked if they could interview me under the auspices of McSweeney's, and then they would just do like ludicrous things. But then I was so naive, I believed them. They'd be like, we're going to interview you, but we're just going to send you one word a day as a question, you know? And I'd be like, think there's nothing unusual. I'd be like, okay. And then Dave Eggers somehow got wind of the whole thing. And then he fired them both from McSweeney's.
What? He fired them?
Yes, because they were fraudulently using the McSweeney's name I think they were going to form their own literary magazine or something. And it was supposedly helmed by this sexually confused Columbia University student they'd made up.
I think that's hilarious. I wish they would have let them continue that. I think
it was a great idea. They were really good spoofers.
Like, I see them, like, they're clearly fucking with you, but I think they're inspired by the writing that you've done and how funny you are. And it's inspired by that, inspired by you. So I see it like, I see how you could get pissed off by that, but also it's hilarious.
Yes, yes.
So I don't see why McSweeney's would fire them. Like, ugh.
What can you say?
Yeah. Well, did they go on to like do well?
Actually, yeah, Amy did. I mean, she. I'm not in touch with her much, but I just read she has another book out. She's just had a lot of books published since then. She has one coming out, or it's about to come out, and it's called Trip, T-R-I-P. I think that's her son's name.
So what did Chelsea Martin say when she would call you at 3 a.m?
She would just leave messages, and then my wife would say, who's this young woman calling you at 3 a.m? Like, she was kind of annoyed like that. So, more like then I think I emailed Chelsea or wrote her and said, you know, please don't call me at 3 a.m. anymore. It's like my wife's going.
Did she apologize to you?
No, I didn't think that was really necessary. I always had a good relationship with her. I mean,
did you stop?
Pardon me?
Did she stop calling you?
Yeah, at 3 a.m. Yes. But no, I always liked her. She was kind of like Chris Danklin. I mean, I can't think of nothing but great things about her.
It was so cool that she got she published a hardback novel kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. And then she was having when Lena Dunham was more culturally acceptable and prominent, then she was getting promoted by her, the ex Lena Dunham. What are you reading? She's like, I'm reading Chelsea Martin. And I was like, wow, that's so great for Chelsea, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get jealous or envious of other writers during your time?
Never.
Never.
No.
Oh.
Is that a bummer?
Do you have any feuds or rivalries?
No.
I feel like you're a pretty easygoing guy.
I try to be. I have a lot of anxiety, but
you have anxiety? Do you ever freak out?
No, I have 8 zillion coping mechanisms. So swimming is part of it, and transcendental meditation, and drinking wine with Raymond Pettibon, or watching Sparrow do meditation and all that stuff.
You still hang out with Sparrow?
I haven't seen him in we read together about a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Together.
I bet you guys could teach a workshop or teach something.
It would be better. Yeah, it would be better. I just love reading with him. I mean, we read it together also a couple of years ago in Ridgewood at some bisexual bar in Queens. That was really fun. It's great. Just the dynamic when we perform is really great. We read together 2 years ago. My wife and me bought a house upstate, and there's a community center there. And then we asked if we could read there together and then have a musician with us. And then all my neighbors came. It was really terrific. And the guy who was promoting the event, he didn't understand Sparrow, so he's getting all nervous at first. I mean, Sparrow has all these kind of shtick things, you know, as soon as he arrives at the venue where we're going to read, he always takes off his shoes. That's not to be pretentious or anything. He just is always barefoot. So then he's walking around barefoot. And then usually when he's reading, he'll have a stack of papers, 50 pages. And he always lets pages fall to the floor and everything. And the guy who's promoting this reading was freaking out when he was dropping his papers. He thought this reading's going to hell in a handbasket, you know, but then everyone was laughing and everyone had a really good time. And so, yeah, I haven't seen him in a year or so though, I think.
Do you want to read something? You said you had a zine.
This is one page from the zine. I wrote, I started to light my cigar with a $20 bill, then changed my mind and lit it with Bitcoin. And then Ray wrote, afterwards, he thought he could attach a meaning to it. And then he has this weird drawing.
Oh, I like that. I think I have one of yours with there's a naked guy and he's in a hat. That's on the front.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's from my more immature phase, I think. That maybe it's called Happy Ending. That was Bill Anthony. He was this great artist. He was a really famous artist. He died in a fire a couple of years ago. He did that cover.
So
also, I liked his style and philosophy because he also tried to be a really great painter. He knew Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein, but he painted really terribly. His figures all look terrible. There was even a movement, I think, in the 70s, William Wegman's roommate was also in it, and it was just called Bad Painting. So both those guys are doing it.
Would you ever do an exhibition where or whatever artists do, where you just have paintings set in a gallery, but then you pair it up one of your lines?
I've never done that, but yeah, that would be great. I mean, that's kind of like what I thought Ray Amir doing with this zine. Like,
yeah,
it's all illustrated and everything. And then, I just go over and then I write and he might write something on it.
Are you selling those? How long? Right now?
No, it's being published by this art gallery. Oops, I'm trying to turn the light here. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, it's being published by an art gallery in New York City called Karma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Ray and me are just about finished, but then I'm going on a trip in later this month. So probably I'll have to get all the high-res art to my designer. Anyway, all this kind of technical garbage. And then maybe it'll probably be out in the fall. And then I think we're going to do 100 copies, and then we're going to sign and number them. And then
do you have a specific font that you prefer?
I always use the very boring, either that New York Times font that's in the scene, which doesn't really seem to go with Ray's weird cacophonous style. And then I like Verdana for some reason. I don't know if you know that font.
Mm-hmm. Do you like the way that it's very straightforward, but then what you're saying is funny? So you're playing on that? The juxtaposition of serious but funny, and you also do that in your life where you present as very straightforward and businesslike, but then you're actually funny.
Yeah, hopefully, yes.
Yeah. Did you always do that, or did you ever use wacky fonts? And oh, this is shit, I'm not doing that.
No, I never use wacky fonts.
You never use Comic Sans?
No, that's good that you know Comic Sans. No, I couldn't do that. I read all those Edward Tufte books on design and everything, so I have to be very serious in my presentation. So.
Yeah, I saw the that New York library that had all your files and stuff from 2004. They're all locked away, so I couldn't even see them over the internet.
Yes, that's I don't know what that's about. That's New York University. They have a library called the Bobst. And then there's a collection called the Fales. And the Fales is one that has this downtown collection. And then they have all this stuff. I think all the stuff they have in mind, though, is pretty. It's all from 42 or younger. So I think I had two little good chapbooks then, I thought. And that's why they did the whole collection. I did a book totally inspired by Joe Brainerd. I just published myself called 6 Short Stories and 7 Short Poems. Mm-hmm. And that was inspired by Joe Brainerd's piece called 6 Short Stories and 7 Short Poems. So I did that. And then I was really into Eastern literature. I read Confucius and Lao Tzu and all those guys. And so then I did a takeoff of Zen cones called Basho's Milk Dud. So those were all kind of ridiculous, cones, 10 of them. And the guy at the Fales Library saw those, so that made me really happy, because one time I just went to the Fales and I tried to check out something, and then the head librarian came out and he's like, "Are you Mike Top?" And I go, "Yes." And he goes, "Did you write Pasha's Milk Dud?" And I was like, "Yes." And then he thought it was really terrific, and then that sent them to acquire all my stuff. So I feel that was kind of like a good period for my writing. That was 1998, 1999, around then.
Well, it's cool they did that, but I wish that they put everything on the internet way back or something.
Yes. No, I agree with you. I mean, the first zine Raymond Pettibon me did was 10 years ago. And it's also a signed limited edition. So people collect it. So I saw one on eBay. I think it's still up there. It's $1,000. So that's insane. So I had a PDF made of it as soon as it came out. So if anyone asks for it, then I'll be here's a free PDF. And with this zine we're doing now, it's the same thing. It'll probably sell for $50 or $100 or I don't know. But I'll just keep a PDF, and anyone who wants it, then I'll just send them the PDF. It just won't have that rarity, it's...
Would you ever upload it to the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive?
I know of that, but I didn't know that's how it worked, that you upload it yourself.
Yeah, you can upload it yourself, and then people can search like terms or your name, and then it'll pop up.
Ah, I see. No, that's good to know. I didn't know that.
I've done that a few times. It looks pretty well from what I can tell.
I see. Well, that's interesting.
So you reached out to Miranda July?
Yes. Just that one time. I just said that art was pre-existing. I find that's also easier. Like a lot of times if you go to an artist, it's best not to say, can you do something brand new for my stinking home? You know, it's like, it's much easier for you to say like, I love this piece of yours, can I use it? And then they're much more like, fine. Like I asked David Berman of the Silver Jews, like he had done like a little cartoon. And I said, can I use this cartoon? And he's like, yeah, sure.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll have to keep that checked away in my head. So I was going to ask you something and then I forgot. Oh, do you think being married like grounded you?
Yes.
Do you think if you weren't married, you would have been going around and maybe not have rent as much?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's Jean Moreau, who the painter, who said to jump into the air, you must first have your feet firmly planted on the ground.
Yeah, I like that. I was going to ask you, like, I like that you're like reading like philosophy and Confucius and those people, and yet you still stick to your style that you've always written in.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever waver and like think about writing in another way, or like writing a Sestina or a Villanelle?
When I write serious, it doesn't seem to work out. As David Lynch would say, it doesn't feel correct. That would be the word he'd use.
You're
like
confident.
That novel. Yeah, like that novel Sparrow Me wrote, like I tried to like make it sound like all crazy, like Philip K. Dick, and it just, I don't think, like, I'm not really happy with that. But.
Yeah, you experimented, and you're like, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, like Sparrow Me did a flip book before that, like, you know, my side was called like Wild Wives, and his was called High Priest of California, or the other way around. That's from Charles Williford, who's a writer we stole those titles from. And then we just illustrated it with illustrations from Chinese takeout menus. And then that was both his funny stuff and my funny stuff. That was much better. When I try and be serious, it just doesn't really work.
Yeah. Do you think this seriousness sabotages your writing? If you go too serious?
And maybe I'm just not very smart and I don't have anything serious to say.
I think you have to be really, really smart and intelligent to pull off humor.
Yeah, I didn't.
Well, thanks for coming on. It's been about 90 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having me on. You're a really good interviewer.